started. Could I have your attention? We're supposed to have one more panelist, and unfortunately, Todd Compton was a presenter in the previous session, and I guess he hasn't. I'm sure he'll be wandering on in here, but I want to leave as much time as possible since we've got four people on this panel. And before I get started, I guess I need to announce what this session is. I think it's already pre-recorded, but I'll go ahead and announce and then announce the changes. There have been a couple of changes from the printed program. This session is a book preview session. Here comes Todd down the hallway now, so we've got a full contingent. But this session is session 273. Persistence of polygamy, and I'm obviously not John Heyman. He was the original chair of the session. My hair's not long enough. I'm too damn old. So it's those are the two issues that make me different from John Hamer. So John Hamer was unable to come to this Sunstone to chair this session, and he sends his regrets. And one other panelist that was scheduled for this a session was Pat Scott. And Pat Scott was unable to attend this session because of family issues. So the panelists that we do have, and I'm going to introduce them in the order that they're going to present. The first presenter will be Todd Compton. The second presenter will be Jeffrey Johnson, and the third presenter will be Chris Blythe. But before they give their presentations, I just want to give a brief introduction and I guess kind of justify why yet another book on Mormon polygamy. That's the obvious elephant in the room. Given the fact that there's been so many excellent studies out there on polygamy, and including one written by a member of this panel and contributor to our volume, Todd Compton. He's written In Sacred Loneliness, one of the benchmark works dealing with Mormon polygamy. So the obvious question is, what justifies yet another book dealing with this subject? And I not only one book, but when complete, it's going to be a three-volume anthology. And I'll explain what the three-volume anthology. The first one we're going to is the flyer I passed you out deals with the first one. But let me just give a series of four reasons why Craig Foster, who's my co-editor, and I feel that there's yet room for another volume. First, this volume, we feel, will provide fresh insights on a number of aspects of polygamy that have heretofore been neglected or inadequately examined. A second reason for this volume is that the essays contained in this volume will provide a different perspective in that each is a brand new, original, never published essay written by a scholar with expertise and or deep interest in the particular topic that they're contributing to. Third, the three volumes are designed to use a kind of a unique approach, what I would call a point-counterpoint format. In evaluating differing, often conflicting viewpoints. And that's particularly evident in the two of the essays in this first volume, one written by Todd Compton and the other one written by Craig Foster, Greg Smith, and I can't remember the third person right now. But anyway, that there's a point-counterpoint approach. And finally, this volume is unique in that it utilizes a variety of methodologies. In addition to what we, you're used to as the traditional historical narrative, these include the use of quantitative statistical analysis and data drawn from the field of physical science. So I guess that's my little thing about why this volume. And I passed, everybody in here should have a flyer which sort of describes the contents of the first volume, and I refer you to that. I just want to go through that very carefully, because that is the volume that's going to be due out next month. That's going to be published in late September. And that volume will contain 8 essays. The first essay written by Don Bradley, a graduate student up at Utah State University in the Religious Studies program. It's going to be entitled Mormon Polygamy Before Nauvoo, the relationship between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger. You notice that he was originally going to do Lucinda Harris, but he found that he had so much material on Fanny Alger that I guess would be a separate essay published in a different venue. And it'll revolve around the central question that's been asked ever since this affair became knowledge of, by, you know, described by Oliver Cowdery as that dirty little nasty affair. Was it indeed just an affair, or was it really truly Joseph Smith's first plural marriage? And he's going to, you know, he analyzes that much more thoroughly than anybody has, including Todd Compton, who has an excellent essay in his own In Sacred Loneliness. The three of the essays in that volume, if you look at that thing that I gave you, focus on what I think is one of the most important revelations ever brought forth by Joseph Smith, and that's section 132, applying to the new and everlasting covenant, because that goes to the heart of the theological justification and support, the undergirding for Mormon polygamy. And I actually wrote two of the essays dealing with 132, one in which I talk about its complex contents and controversial legacy. And then in a second essay, Craig Foster focuses on the Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, in terms of Joseph Smith's concept of expanding a family, and he sees that as a prime motivating factor. And then yet on a third essay, if you haven't already heard enough about 132, I discuss the reaction of the RLDS church to 132, their conflicting responses and changing perceptions, because much of that goes to the heart of how they perceived and viewed Joseph Smith. I mean, their position, as you're probably aware, is that Joseph, for a long time, the party line in the RLDS church was that Joseph Smith neither practiced nor condoned polygamy, that he didn't have anything to do with the practice. It was something concocted. 132, the revelation, was concocted by Brigham Young after the Saints got to Utah. That's the official party line that that was, but they've softened that position and moved away from that. In addition to those four essays that I've described, Volume 1 will also contain four additional essays that surround Joseph Smith's direct involvement with polygamy. One of those discusses Joseph Smith's marriages to women who were already married to other men. And this is explored in an essay by Brian Hales, Joseph Smith and the Puzzlement of Polyandry. Some of you that might have come to last year's Sunstone, I don't know if anybody attended the session where Brian Hales gave a paper where he gave his preliminary research on that in a session like this, which I was involved in. It created a little bit of fireworks. But anyway, that's one of the essays relating to Joseph Smith's involvement. Two additional essays that I alluded to earlier. This microphone is just not working right at all. I don't know. Cheap equipment or something. I guess I just have to keep my hand on the darn thing. But two additional essays probe the equally controversial topic of Joseph Smith's marriages to teenagers, which is significant because 11 very young women, or one-third of the Mormon leader's plural wives, ranged in age from 14 to 20. And that's one essay written by Craig L. Foster, Greg Smith, and Dan Keller. Is entitled Teenage Brides and Polygamy Patterns at the Time of of marriage. And a counter essay, as I mentioned, deals with this topic is by Todd Compton, who's going to be sharing his findings with us today, entitled Teen Marriage in American Culture, What Was the Norm? And then the final essay in Volume 1 focuses on the topic of polygamous offspring fathered by Joseph Smith. Hugo Perrigo utilizes scientific analysis in an attempt to answer the fundamental question, did the Mormon leader, in fact, produce any progeny through any of his plural wives? And that's been a point of controversy, particularly between the LDS and the RLDS churches, because various spokesmen within the LDS church have asserted that there were polygamous offspring, and the RLDS church has asserted that there wasn't. Now, forthcoming and still in its final stages of completion are the essays for Volume 2. And Volume 2 is subtitled Mormon Polygamy in the 19th Century. And that's due for publication in April of 2011. And that volume will focus on, as I say, Mormon polygamy in the 19th century, the major focus being on its practice by various Mormon factions, especially the Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Jeffrey O. Johnson, in his presentation today, will be discussing one of the essays that will be going into that volume entitled For Time and Eternity, The Complex Brigham Young Household. And that, in fact, will be the opening essay in Volume 2. And then we get to Volume 3, and we expect Volume 3 to be ready for publication a year from now. So maybe there'll be a Sunstone session focusing on Volume 3, which is Polygamy Among Mormon Fundamentalists, focusing on developments in the 20th and the 21st centuries. As you're all well aware, you know, Mormon fundamentalism was spawned by the abandonment of polygamy by the mainstream LDS Church, commencing with the 1890 Manifesto. And in that last and final volume will be a series of 9 essays by different writers well-versed on various topics. The author of the first essay in that volume is Christopher Blythe, and he will be presenting his essay in his presentation today discussing that. He's a graduate student in religious studies at Utah State, due to enter the PhD program at Florida State University in the fall. And he'll be talking about the precursors of Mormon fundamentalism during the late 19th and early 20th century. I should also just say a couple of words about our other two panelists. Jeffrey O. Johnson is a retired archivist from the LDS Church Archives. He was formerly a Utah State archivist. Is that correct? Yeah, how many years were you there?
For the state, I was 14 years.
14 years, and so he's worked, and then before that he worked for the LDS Church. So he's, the beginning of his career was with the LDS Church, then he went for the state, and now he's retired, happily retired like me, enjoying the fruits of retirement. And Todd Compton hardly needs any introduction. I mean, this guy is an incredible scholar. The reason he was late coming in here today, he was discussing a major book project that he's dealing with, an update of Leland Gentry's classic study of the Far West and the Missouri period, the Missouri Mormon Wars, and that, an excellent presentation. Of course, he's also working on a biography. I don't know how far along it is, on Jacob Hamblin. And so, I mean, he's a Renaissance Mormon scholar. So anyway, we'll go ahead and proceed in that order with our speakers. And I hope you guys can handle this microphone, because it's just really, it doesn't want to stay. So it's there for a moment. Go ahead. I guess you can do it in that one. If you want to do it sitting, maybe that's even better. If they can, I guess people can see you because they're all down there.
I have a hand up. No, would you?
And another handout. Okay.
Whoever.
Okay.
this is actually a handout for my second essay that will be in the third book. I gave a summary of this second essay at another Sunstone, and a person there asked me for the list of books that I'd been talking about, and I didn't have it, so I thought I'd do it for this Sunstone. So if any of you want to know where to begin in reading about polygamy, books about polygamy, here are some books I recommend. Okay. Okay, and I should say at the beginning that my book is in a way a response, my paper here is in a way a response to Craig Foster and his two co-writers, Gregory Smith and I believe David Keller. However, I haven't read their article, but I have read things they've written on the internet. And the things they've written have been very helpful to me, and my article has been influenced by them. Even though we disagree on some issues, what they've written has influenced what I've written. So, in one way, I guess you could call it a fruitful discussion, from my point of view. We'll see if they look at it from their point of view. Among Joseph Smith's 33 wives, by my count, was a 14-year-old, Helen Marr Kimball, who later married Horace Whitney and lived out her life in Salt Lake City, Utah. Though it isn't strictly relevant to my paper, I believe that it is unlikely that the marriage was consummated, though there is no definite evidence. And there was a pattern in Utah in which people, older men married underage women and then did not consummate them until they were older. And I think that probably is the pattern here. Family historians call marriage to 14 and 15-year-olds early marriage. That's a term I'll be using, early marriage. The question I ask in this paper is, how do such polygamous marriages relate to marriage norms and customs in New England and the Northeast states in America in the 19th century? Were marriages to 14 and 15-year-olds common and accepted at the time, or were they fairly rare? Other people have asked this question, and similar questions have answered them imprecisely. For example, I'm going to make up this statement here. In history, such marriages to teens were common, end quote. Okay. But in what time periods of history and in what places? Marriage age has fluctuated significantly over time and geographically from place to place. And there is a difference between marriages to 19-year-olds or even 16-year-olds and marriages to 14-year-olds. So I tried to be more precise in asking the question and in answering it. I thought that comparison of Joseph Smith marriage practices to the culture of the states where Mormonism began and in the 19th century was more relevant than comparison of Joseph Smith's marriage practices to exotic places and times. My conclusion is that marriage to 14-year-olds was quite rare in New England and the northeastern states in the 19th century. And I base that conclusion on statistical data. And I'm not a statistician, I'm not a family historian, but I've tried to use people who are widely respected family historians who use statistics. So here are some statistics about marriage age. And we could look at lots of ages, but I'm going to, for this presentation, 15 minutes, I'm just going to stick to age 14. Okay, here's the data for 3,055 native-born women in first marriages in 1848 to 1850, according to a family history scholar named Monahan. And this is in New Jersey. For marriages age 14, he has 0.1%. In other words, it isn't even 1%, it's 0.1% of 1%. So that's fairly rare. For age 15, he had 0.4%. Again, it isn't even 1%. Just for comparison, in 1947 in New Jersey, there were no marriages age 14. Age 15, 0.2%. It wasn't even a 1%. When you get to age 16, there was 1%. So marriages at age 14 in New Jersey at those times were rare. Okay, a few more statistics here. In 1850, this is data at a website called IPOMS that reproduces census evidence. I won't go into their entire methodology, but it's widely respected. In 1850, in the entire USA, for females married at age 14, it was 0.3% of 1%. So it wasn't even 1%. Age 15, you do have 1.19%. Okay, a few more from IPOMS. I think my first one is IPOMS. Well, I have IPOMS in 1880. Female is 0.45%. It isn't even 1% yet, but it's higher than it was earlier. Okay, 1850, New England. That's quite close to, actually, Joseph Smith's period in Nauvoo. 1850, New England states, females. They don't have any data. There were no reported instances for ages 14 and 15. For marriages at age 16, 0.84, almost 1%. So when you get to age 16, that's getting to be fairly common, fairly accepted. 14 and 15 are fairly rare. I'll give you one more. 1850, Middle Atlantic region, which is the states of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. There was no data for women married at age 14. For women married at age 15, they're at 1.06%. So there's 1%. So according to that data, marriage at age 14 was quite rare. Okay. As I researched my paper, I found that general patterns relating to marriage age were relevant. For example, when the economy is bad, marriage age rises because young people understandably delay marriage if they have no jobs and cannot afford marriage. Another example, in colonies and the frontier, marriage age tends to lower because women are often in short supply. When there is a shortage of women, there is increased competition for wives, and this drives the marriage age down. Historians of marriage age have pointed to a European pattern of marriage, including England, in which marriage age is comparatively high, as opposed to other parts of the world. BYU historian Catherine M. Daines, in her book, More Wives Than One, Transformation of the Mormon Marriage System, 1840 to 1910, shows that marriage age in Mormon polygamy was lower than in northeastern United States because polygamy created what you could call an artificial shortage of women, especially in specific limited communities. In other words, if a limited number of men are marrying plural wives, that drives down the availability of women in those communities. Thus, there was increased competition for available women, and marriage ages went down. And so, anecdotally, I've been talking statistically, anecdotally, we have a number of examples of marriage age, people being married at age 14, 15. I conclude that the cultural legacy of early marriage in 19th century Mormon polygamy is a troubling one. The example of such marriages as practiced by 19th century Mormon leaders undoubtedly has had an impact on 20th century fundamentalist polygamists, in whose closed communities competition for women understandably drives the marriage age down, and early marriage for women, many women, results. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
How's that? You want to talk about
this? Jeff after him, though?
Oh, yeah.
For my essay for this book, my responsibility was to talk about Brigham Young's family. I've studied over the years a lot of plural families, and I've been very interested in Brigham Young's family and how it worked, and how the children, the wives, what their life was like in this family. It's interesting, I've become very enamored by the closeness of the Young family. I think it's so unusual with so many wives involved and so many children, how they were able to develop a very close relationship, and how this relationship lasted in the children and the wives. Even those children who left Mormonism seemed to be very well connected in the family. And there are two things that I think most successful plural marriages have. One is that the first wife is very supportive of plural marriage and theology, and it helps with the family. This is true with Bathsheba Smith and the George A. Smith family, where she was very helpful to the other wives and very close with them. The other thing is that in plural families where the husband stopped marrying and let the family develop a stable relationship without bringing young wives in. That's another thing that helped plural families be successful. Well, in Brigham Young's case, neither one of those things happened. Well, Mary Ann Angel was supportive. She kept herself quite distant from the rest of the family and the wives. Susie Young Gates says that she never remembers Mary Ann being at the Lion's House. She said, "We always respected her, but we were never very emotional, very close to her." And the other thing is Brigham kept bringing wives in, younger wives in. So you would think that the family would be torn apart by that. I'm not exactly sure what happened to keep the family close together. I think two things. One is that Brigham Young was able to have a close relationship with his children. They lived in a close association. Even those that didn't live in the Lion House lived close enough that they often saw their father, and he saw them, and he knew them. And somehow he was able to let them know that they were part of this family and they were important to the family. The other thing is, I think maybe the place of the first wife was taken by some of the other wives, and there's some hints with Clarissa and Zina, who did things to that maybe in other families the first wife would have done to bring the family close together. With that introduction, my essay is really too long for this presentation, so I thought what I'd do is just give you a little flavor of it. In 1866, Catherine Van Valkenburg Wade published a book entitled The Mormon Prophet and His Harem, or an Authentic History of Brigham Young, His Numerous Wives and Children. This is 11 years before Brigham's death. This book became wildly popular, going through six editions and many printings in 3 years. Mrs. Wade gave the public a fanciful view inside of Young's family life and home, a place where many people were interested in peeking. On one occasion, Brigham Young complained, "Ladies who come to my office very frequently say, 'I wonder if it would hurt his feelings if I ask him how many wives he has.' I would as lief they should ask me that question as any other, but I'd rather see them anxious to learn about the gospel. Although Brigham said that he didn't mind answering questions about his wife, he did not do it often. His Victorian sensibilities apparently made it hard for him to talk about so sexual a subject as his relationship with his wives. And his Yankee independence bristled at the invitation of this overcoming his privacy. He gave instructions to the church historian's office that, quote, he did not wish but little history of his family given. He also was concerned about the privacy for his children, who were growing up under the watchful eyes of both Mormon faithful and non-Mormon critics. His children's activities were often noted in the press, including criticism of any perceived misdeeds. Sometimes it's really interesting how the Tribune would misconstrue some of their activities. And of course, they weren't a perfect family. There were, like any family, there were things happening that, that there were always people watching. Brigham married his first plural wife in 1842 after Joseph had told him about the doctrine. Lucy Ann Decker Seeley, whose husband had left her with two small children, maybe three, we're not sure if the baby died before he left or not. Brigham had known the Decker family, her father, for a long time, even before they were Mormons. This marriage set a pattern which tells us something about Brigham's attitude towards this new doctrine. He often married women who were separated from their previous husbands and needed support. Also, many times he married women from families that he had known for many years. This created the situation that most of all, well, all of his wives were, had a New England heritage except one who was born in he was very lucky in his first, his first wife had died and left him with two daughters. Marian Angel, who he married in Kirtland, was very, very lucky choice. She was a person who was able to take care of both the physical and emotional needs of his two orphan daughters, as well as her six children. While Brigham Young spent most of his activities on church activities, she was able to make sure the children had what they needed. Before Joseph's death, Brigham Young married four plural wives. Besides Lucy Decker, he married two converts from Boston, Augusta Adams Cobb and Harriet Cook. He married them on the same day. Augusta was a 40-year-old woman who had left her husband and children, all except the two youngest, to join the Mormons in Nauvoo. Harriet was a single 19-year-old convert who traveled with Augusta from Boston. Brigham Young had known them when he had been in New England. Just before Joseph's death, Joseph sealed him to his youngest plural wife, Clarissa, who was the younger sister of Lucy Decker. All four of these women would be a part of Brigham's household during his life, and at his death, share in his estate, and three of them would have children by Brigham. After Joseph's death and before the Nauvoo Temple was finished, Brigham was sealed to 15 women. Five had been wives of Joseph Smith. Emily Dow Partridge records in her autobiography, after the prophet's death, she's talking about she had been married to the prophet Joseph. After the prophet's death, I entered into plural marriage. I was married to Brigham Young according to the law of proxy. So these women who were sealed to someone else had the concept that Brigham was a proxy for their husbands. He was married. He had children by three of of Joseph Smith's wives. So 13 of his children would be, Joseph's in the hereafter. Emily gives us an idea that he considered her children less than his own children. It doesn't seem like it really worked that way. Emily's children received the education that the other children had, and Joseph Don Carlos Young, her son, was one of the very prominent of Brigham Young's sons. One other wife, Margaret Pierce, was sealed to her dead husband, Morris Whitesides, for eternity, and Brigham Young for life. And she had one child by Brigham Young, who she named after her first husband. So they knew where they were going to be in the hereafter, but he also had a close relationship with Brigham Young. It became obvious that Brigham Young did not have the same type of relationship with each of these women. And this is confirmed by a statement made by Horace Greeley in 1859, that he made to Horace Greeley, where he said, "I have some aged women sealed to me under the principle of sealing, which I would no more think of making a wife than I would my grandmother." Many of these aged women referred to were sealed to Brigham in the Navi Temple. He was married to 19 women during this period before they left Nauvoo. Two were widows, two more were widows of Joseph Smith. Eight were older than him. Some of the older women were relatives of his wives and had non-Mormon inactive husbands, which meant they could not be sealed to them. Only two of the 19 that he married during this period had children by Brigham Young. He had three children from plural marriages while they were in Nauvoo. Lucy Decker gave birth to a son. Emily Dot Partridge gave birth to a son. It's kind of interesting. She said people who weren't used to plural marriage came to look at her son, who she had named after her father, Edward Partridge Young, thinking that he would be deformed in some way because it was from a plural marriage. And Harriet Cook, just a few days before they left, this made it so it would delay her joining the family in Iowa. When he arrived in Utah, he had been sealed to 44 women, but many had left him or died or had remained with their own families. We have letters where women have wrote him and asked that their sealings be canceled, and he seemed okay to do that. And in one case, Mary Woodward, he said, "If you and your children are ever hungry, I'll be glad to help you, even though you've had your sealing canceled." He also referred to women who had not become a part of his family and were living with other men when in 1859 he wrote that his wife, Clarissa Blake Homestead, could be sealed to the man she had been living with all these years. I didn't find that the sealing was canceled or that she was sealed to Brother Homestead. During the 30 years Brigham Young lived in Utah, he married 12 more women. Several were older women who had endured hardships and sacrificed for the church and needed support. Amanda Barnes Smith, whose husband and son had been killed at Hodge Mill. Elizabeth Jones, who had lost her money helping the Danish, the Welsh, come to Utah and desired to have her sealing from her husband Dan Jones canceled. Hannah Tatfield King, who was a literary woman in Utah, but her husband was a non-member, and so she asked to be sealed to Brigham. But during this period, he also married
young women. He married two who were divorced from their husbands, Harriet Barney Sagers. She had four children by her husband, and she had one by Brigham, and Mary Van Cott Cobb, who had one by her former husband and one by Brigham. Anyway, as the family developed, they realized that they needed to spread more, that they Brigham bought homes for some of his wives so that their children could move out. The interesting thing that I find is that while Brigham Young seemed very open to allow his wives to leave if they wanted to, none of them that had children by Brigham ever married anyone else. And the ones who were childless but also lived in the Lion House were very close to his children. Nema Carter, who had no children by Brigham, but had been in charge of the kitchens in the Lion House, lived up into the 20th century, where Brigham's children helped her and made sure that she had the things she needed. Anyway, a complex family, a family that had a lot of difficulties in bringing together a close family, but a family that I feel was really quite successful. Thank you.
Today I'm speaking on my chapter on polygamy in a time period from 1904, when the LDS Church firmly, officially ended polygamy, and up to the point of 1929, when Loren Woolley ordained a set of seven men as a clear hierarchical structure of the Mormon fundamentalist movement. During this 30-year period, many alternative attempts to continue Mormon plural marriage occurred. I guess a little background. From 1890 to 1904, and even a little before, the LDS Church, a prophet, Wilford Woodruff, John Taylor, George Buchanan and Joseph F. Smith, along with other apostles assigned to the task, continued to keep plural marriage alive through secret sealings, through across the dinner table conversation. But we did experience, this was a time period soon after that when the church officially closed the doors on, well, firmly closed the doors on plural marriage after the Reed-Smoot hearings. Mormon fundamentalists faced a time period where they didn't know, and I'm using the term Mormon fundamentalists wrongly there, those continuing plural marriage didn't know where they stood in the church. This was a time period where they had no set hierarchy that they had access to in the same way they did in those first 14 years. They had no set meetings. They tried to attend their local LDS churches, just like other members of the church. There was no publication just for polygamists. Truth volumes didn't come out for 30 years later. What they did have was friendships, a network, from people that had entered into polygamy largely from these unofficial ceremonies. Don't read too much in the word unofficial there. These ceremonies that were performed in private. Children were grown up in post-manifesto polygamous families, and they continued to believe in polygamy, but at a time when church leaders were no longer sealing these marriages. In many cases, they struggled to know what to do. So in my chapter, I look at this 30-year period as a search both for legitimacy How can we continue this principle that we believe prophets of God have taught us, speaking in the words of a early 20th century proto-fundamentalist, what I'm referring to, and also a search for structure. How can we organize ourselves? How can we teach our children? In about the 19-teens, there's a series of excommunications. This will come through men that have been sealed by Judson Tolman, a local patriarch in Salt Lake, through men that have been sealed by John Woolley, another patriarch. These men both claimed that Joseph F. Smith had privately instructed them to continue, even after the second manifesto I referred to continue plural marriage. Many of these excommunication trials, you'll see that the people participating in them really did believe that the church hierarchy was still behind plural marriage. It was a shock to them to think that Joseph F. Smith really wasn't supporting them, that the Second Manifesto really was what it said it was, because the first wasn't, right? In this loose movement, there's two main divisions. And I'll read from a rough draft of my paper here describing those two divisions. One division, eventually providing the dominant strain of Mormon fundamentalism, believed that they were merely continuing the covert but authorized practice of plural marriage. They turned to individuals such as John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley, apostles, as well as local patriarchs such as John W. Woolley and others, professing a commission from an apostle or church president to seal marriages. Most believed that President Joseph F. Smith still secretly supported their cause. The men who performed the ceremonies thought they acted with his approval and on his go-ahead. The network of believers that formed around the wake of the post-1904 polygamous underground made no attempt to create a formal organization. They were members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, practicing their traditional religious beliefs. A second grouping, the one I'll spend the rest of my paper discussing, looked towards new charismatic individuals, specifically at this time period between 1904 and the 1920s, John T. Clark and Samuel Eastman, who taught the importance of plural marriage, resistance to change, and millennial expectations. Both movements, the first I mentioned, both Eastman and Clark, turned to prophecies of a messianic figure, the One Mighty and Strong, who they felt was represented in Eastman or Clark, respectively, neither of which had held high positions in the LDS Church or claimed their authority through any private commission. Instead, they awaited a prophesied setting and order in which the One Mighty and Strong, themselves, would restructure the church's hierarchy, ousting the former leadership. These two leaders and their followers believed and often practiced plural marriage, but the crux of their position was the publication of prophecies of an impending religious revolution. These men were local prophets that wanted to get their ideas across, so they published many pamphlets. Rather than promoting polygamy in public, something that will happen with truth publications later on, they're pushing the resistance to the change, that a new age is going to come in which things will be set in order. I'll spend a few minutes talking about Samuel Eastman, because I think he's one of the most original thinkers in this early time period that's rarely discussed in any literature. Samuel Eastman is a proto-fundamentalist without any insider status or knowledge of the inner workings of the church hierarchy. He had no idea that Joseph F. Smith had encouraged plural marriage to continue till 1904. He thought church hierarchy members had continued plural marriage, and he thought that was hypocrisy. For Eastman, more important than the church's disavowal of plural marriage was likely the embarrassment he felt when church leadership during the Reed-Smoot hearing When church leaders during the Reed-Smoot hearing seemed to cave in under pressure during their rigorous trials. Rather than building from the seeds of post-manifesto plural marriage, as the Woolley movement would eventually do, Eastman built a new understanding of Mormonism from the ground up. Although an individual rarely discussed, I believe his ideas at this early period from 1904 were seeds to even Woolley fundamentalism today. These ideas had already settled and distributed through the polygamous people of the time. 7 years after advancing his prophetic claims, Samuel Eastman also instituted the first organization of Mormon fundamentalists called the Work of God's Kingdom. and you'll see similarities if you have a background in Mormon fundamentalists today, but he referred to his small group as a temporary fold, not intended to replace the one true church. In his sermons, he often justified the organization by stating that it was only formed after a number of you, his flock, quote, had been ruthlessly ejected from the Father's church by your shepherds. He reasoned that if the church wouldn't offer the ability to worship for these polygamists, then he could offer a substitute. Wasn't as good as the church, but something they could have until this setting in order. He sometimes referred to the LDS church with the term semi-apostate. It was a fixable situation, but things were out of whack. In his writings, two additional ideas that are crucial in later fundamentalism emerge. One, that priesthood and all ordinances don't disappear with excommunication. That fundamentalists who were living a righteous lifestyle, in his view, didn't sacrifice any of their blessings by what he viewed as persecution from the church. And also this idea of the one mighty and strong. I could go on in the chapter I do about Eastman's call, his interesting life. He joined the church in 1885 in England, came over to Utah the next year, and was part of these zealous sermons about the importance of maintaining polygamy. He was immersed into this world. And as an early convert, he took every one of those sermons to heart, but didn't have a time yet, didn't have a chance, to live plural marriage until after the manifesto comes. And as you might expect, he's excommunicated pretty quickly thereafter. But there's some really interesting anecdotes that you'll read in the chapter. Another thing I would mention that quickly, I'm sure my time's up, Samuel Eastman is one example of this one mighty and strong figure. He grew more popular during the Depression, and quickly his ideas faded away. At least the knowledge of Samuel Eastman as a man faded away. But some of his theology was passed down through other thinkers. In this section, the next turning point for proto-fundamentalism is the development of Nathaniel Baldwin's factory in East Mill Creek during the 1920s. This is the first chance that fundamentalists, proto-fundamentalists at the time, are able to work together. Many of them are living in the same neighborhood. And this network that before was very loose has gotten much tighter. In this factory, in the words of Brian Hale, the men working for Baldwin and serving upon the board of directors of his companies read like a who's who of the fundamentalist movement. And he lists a series of about 23 well-known names. These meetings, and in the chapter I'll talk about individual meetings that meant a lot to these workers, they discussed every issue that for 30 years was talked about privately in families and homes and occasionally outside the family circle. But this time, these men were meeting together and forming an unofficial group, functioning somewhat like an unofficial elders' quorum. Men meeting together and discussing every change as it was happening during this period of transformation. Not just plural marriage, but when the garment was changed in 1923, and there's a series of meetings discussed in these series of great diaries. More diaries are being released over time from 1920s and 30s. And it's brilliant. These men are excited, and they're discussing over each of these details. I'll probably stop here, so I haven't paid attention to time at all. So I think it's a really interesting time period, and the greatest challenge I've had as I'm writing this chapter, and as I'm studying Mormon fundamentalist people at all, right, is to express the humanity of it. What was it like to live in a situation where your religion was changing? The testimony you had when you were a 12-year-old, now that you're 60, feels like a different thing. And it was a time of great stress. And so I hope that I'll be able to achieve something to show the humanity of these individuals so we can see the world through their eyes. Thank you for your time.
We are blessed with another half hour. I mean, these guys were better than I expected. I guess I I deferred doing a presentation of my own because I thought that they would consume most of the time. So we've got all kinds of time for questions. So I hope you'll feel free to come forward and ask away. And direct your questions to who you want to answer it. Yeah, that'd be amongst the four of us.
Maybe I can help by asking a question for each of you, and you can remember your own question and answer. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, the one I just barely finished. Isn't the second manifesto worded almost exactly as the first manifesto, which would cause the confusion about whether, to some people, like the patriarchs that were wondering whether it was already done? Todd, your question is, if you were to turn around and describe what it would look like to explain what would be inappropriate, what the difference between someone that a plural wife that's underage and just any other common person who's, well, not an underage, but a very young person that they're marrying, the difference between what it makes and that the fact that it's multiple wives versus just the only wife they ever had, and kind of look at it from that point of view. And then for yours, the question would be about Mary Elizabeth Rollins and how she was the plural wife of Brigham Young, but he didn't really take care of her, even after Adam Leitner died, take care of her financially, and that later in life, she didn't have very much money, and after Brigham Young died, petitioned John Taylor and other people and received a stipend of like $100 a year to live on for the entire year as a widow who is a former wife of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. The church didn't really help out that particular widow very well, and I was just curious what your take on his relationship with her would be viewed in that case.
You got a two. So you gave two questions. You asked the first question about the 1904 manifesto and Elizabeth Leitner. So I guess go ahead with the first. I guess you answer the first question, Chris, and then I'll let Jeff answer the second one.
I think he asked me.
Oh, you're okay. I'm sorry. I mean, Todd.
I think that's good. The second manifesto's, the first manifesto seems clear to many people. And so the second manifesto does have very similar wording. But fundamentalists will even, during this time period, refer to 11 manifestos. They're feeling all of these statements. They seem to be saying the same thing. So when do you stop? When do you take them seriously? It's a struggle.
Eric, I'm sorry. I don't know if I understood your question that much. But one interesting aspect of what I'm trying to do is the data I'm looking at is for non-polygamous in the northeastern states and in New England states. Obviously, it's for non-polygamous. Whereas what's going on with polygamous is if they add a 14-year-old to their family, that isn't their first marriage. It's a different kind of situation, obviously. And often when polygamous men married these younger women, they were a lot older. While non-polygamous, if they marry a 14-year-old, often they were, say, 17 or 18. The husband was possibly not that much older. But beyond that, I don't have much. I don't know if I understood your question sufficiently. But in statistical analysis, there's all kinds of tricky little things in history. Again, I'm not a statistician, but I tried to work with some of these issues.
I think Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner is an example that we need to understand that I don't think Brigham saw her as a part of his family. Of course, he understood that she was sealed to Joseph Smith and that her non-Mormon husband couldn't be sealed. He understood that he stood as proxy for Joseph Smith. But I don't think he knew or understood or thought that he had some, marriage with her. I think she thought that she would become a part of his family. But, I mean, he was busy, and she went on with Adam and lived the rest of her life with Adam. And just like Clarissa Blake, who was living with her husband, Homestead, I don't think Brigham saw this as a marriage. In fact, what he said to Horace Greeley is, I wouldn't consider making these women my wives like more than my grandmother. So I think she's... I think if he knew that she needed him, he would probably be thinking that he needed to take care of Joseph's wives as the president of the church. But her problems really developed after his death. And I think her asking the church to help her was that she was Joseph's wife and should have help. And some of the other women, like Helen Mar Whitney, and some of the other women said, yes, yeah, she's Joseph's wife, so we need to help her. Does that answer your question?
Well, he wasn't the richest person in the state, so you think he could chill
out a little happy. But I don't think that he felt like he might not have known she needed them, but I mean, he helped people, but I don't think he saw her as part of his. I mean, there were a lot of women like that who had been sealed to him that never became a part of his family.
What do you know about D. Michael Quinn's research about John Taylor in 1886 receiving a revelation that plural marriage had never been done away with, and that he was instructed by the other side to set apart five men to see that even though the church would sign a manifesto, they would keep plural marriage alive? What do you know about that?
Absolutely. So the first person to tell this story in great detail and spread it begins with Lauren Woolley. And Woolley's sharing this to family members. We have a few cousins. They're talking about it in an earlier time. But in these Baldwin meetings in the 1920s, at the very end of John Woolley's, his father's life, is when Lauren finally has a good-sized audience. The network's been brought together, and Lauren's been able to teach this story, to explain. I began my talk saying that my chapter discusses their search for authority. In the 1920s, Lauren Woolley is able to really bring hope to these individuals with the story that John Taylor, in 1886, not only had a revelation, which I think is historically undisputable now, but also had an experience and set apart men with that revelation to continue plural marriage. And it was in that Baldwin meeting that I think he found his first real converts that would continue what I call Orthodox Mormon fundamentalism or Woolley fundamentalism, which makes up the vast majority of fundamentalists today.
I've got a question. It's not for any specific panelists, but if it sounds okay, it's kind of a general question. It's more of a speculative one. Mr. Compton, in your book, you talk a lot about the legitimacy of Joseph Smith and when he actually received the revelation, like from the date it was actually written down, but some years earlier he received it. That in combination with the two manifestos, I was just wondering, can you speculate on the reason that the church would place so much secrecy on polygamy when it made such grandiose truth claims like prophetic revelation, modern days, the Book of Mormon? It had these really big claims, and it freely told the world about these things, but it hid polygamy, which seems kind of counterintuitive. Can you speculate why they might have done that? What might be the causes of that?
In 1882, John Taylor, in a revelation, is told that polygamy isn't for the world. That's not to be taught by missionaries. but that it's related to an inner circle in the church, right? It's the way Joseph Smith practiced it. And it really was only practiced not that way from 52 to 90, right? Obviously, I think it's to avoid persecution.
It's interesting. Nauvoo polygamy was secret, just as post-manifesto polygamy became secret. And I think some secrecy is justified. I mean, some religious secrecy is justified. In the history of religions, there are many religions that have secret aspects of their religion. Look at the Hopi religion. They have rites that are very secret and can be punished by death. Hopis, Sunnis, if they're revealed. I think the problem with, especially with post-manifesto polygamy, was, and here everyone ought to read Carmen Hardy's book, Solemn Covenant, and the appendix he has about what I call conflicting truth claims, and he calls lying for the Lord. And sometimes it seems justified to use deception, as in war, often the spies, you know, and it's deception is kind of like an aspect, can be an aspect of secrecy, and secrecy can be an aspect of deception. However, Hardy's point is that even if you do use deception and you think you're justified in using it, it can often come and harm you when other people find out, you know, that you have been using deception, and that, and in the case of post-manifest polygamy, it became obvious, you know, over, you know, a very short time after 1890.
My question has to do with Mormon polygamy in the wider American scene. I recently watched a documentary on Waco and the Branch Davidian and all of that, and one of the documentary covered congressional hearings on what happened a couple of years later, and they actually called a scholar to come in and say, you know, tell us what was going on with these religious people. And she says that, you know, it's hard to tell exactly what was going on with them, but it is in the American public mind. They are ready to believe certain things about cultish-type groups. And the pattern is that the main leader is practicing some kind of polygamy. He's taking on underage wives. They're sequestered in some way, usually somewhere in the West, and they believe in some kind of modern-day prophet, something. And this is a pattern that you can sell pretty easily to the American public without a whole lot of evidence. And not to say that it doesn't happen, but so I'm wondering, it seems like in other areas, in other kinds of groups that have sort of appeared to practice polygamy on the American scene, besides the Mormons, who are not necessarily breakouts from the Mormons, although there are plenty of those, it sort of seems to take a certain form that does sort of fall into this pattern. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about whether the Mormons sort of set the pattern in the mind of the American public, or did we follow a pattern that was sort of already there? Or and if you want to throw in a little bit more, what is it that has always incurred the wrath of the American people on this sort of setup from the days of Brigham Young right down to the incident in Texas a few years ago?
Are you referring to the FLDS? Or are you referring? You're referring to the FLDS situation. Yeah, I mean that's a whole complex situation, and the way it was handled by Texas authorities. I don't know if this really answers your question, but I think that there was the shadow of Waco, because there were eerie similarities between David Koresh and Warren Jeffs and his followers on the Yearning for Zion Ranch. And so I think that the Texas authorities moved on to Warren Jeffs, and it was really unjustified on a lot of different levels, because they envisioned him as another David Koresh. They saw it because, you know, he made some pretty extreme statements, and, you know, he's issued a lot of apocalyptic prophecies and all of that, and so they were fearful that they would have another Waco. And so I think from the perspective, I'm not defending what they did. I think what they did was absolutely reprehensible. But, you know, trying to get into the minds of the Yahoo Texas mentality, what they were trying to do, yeah, I mean, there's this Yahoo, I mean, this cowboyish, you know, we saw 8 years of it in the White House. We won't go there, but I mean, but at the same time, they were trying to act in a preemptive way to prevent what had happened at Waco, because they saw that they saw perhaps history was going to repeat itself. That's my best answer. I don't know if any of the rest of you have a different explanation or want to add to that.
I have no information about this, but I find it really interesting. Two things. One is they seem to be encouraged, though, by people who have left the fundamentalist movement and have brought up stories about what's happening from the inside. And this is an interesting group, I think, of people who have all this hostility because of the movement. And they seem to have a lot of influence in the thinking of this group. But I've also often wondered, too, I've often wondered, you know, how many girls in Texas are getting pregnant at 15? And no one is arresting the men that made them pregnant. But somehow, because they're in this group, then it's a horrible thing and these men must be arrested because they're getting girls pregnant at 15. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Chris, you have something to say?
I taught a course a year ago now on new religious movements, and we talked about this framework that you've described here, of a counter-cult movement that's labeling each of these new religious movements in the same way, right? There's an expected course of action. One of my favorite scholars, Terrell Givens, wrote a book called Viper on the Hearth, and he shows this pattern going back further and anti-Catholicism in America. So I think it's a really interesting topic, and the same things you brought up about how ex-members play into it. It's part of what sociologists of new religions have been discussing for years. And there's lots of great articles and books that have analyzed your question.
This is maybe a question to Newell about your plans for the other tomes in this series. Is anybody going to write about the present day belief that apparently survives in the LDS Church, that polygamy is an eternal principle? The 132nd section is still in the scriptures, and marriages are contracted for afterlife in temples to this day, second wives and so on. Is anybody going to comment about the fact that it's never been repudiated as a principle, that it will be practiced in the hereafter?
Well, I actually do that in the essay that I write on 132 that actually is going to be in Volume 1, even though, I mean, my discussion of 132 goes right up to the present day and elucidates and discusses those various issues, because I argue that, you know, some people are ignorant of all of the contents and the complexity of 132. Says, why doesn't the church just abolish or repeal 132? Because when they think of 132, it's easy to think of it in simplistic terms. But anybody who has studied 132 carefully knows that it deals with all of these other issues. It deals with eternal marriage. It deals with exaltation. It deals with the very core values of modern-day Mormonism. And if you repealed 132, it'd be just like saying, well, you know, all of these other things that we've taught with these essential Mormon principles are null and void. And I point that out very strongly in the essay that I have in the first volume as part of the legacy of Joseph Smith. By contrast, the RLDS, they argue it as a spurious document, and it's interesting the statements that they made, and I trace that right down to the present, because they denied that Joseph Smith ever received a revelation that became 132. They say it was concocted by Brigham Young. And that's an interesting parallel story. So you've got these two parallel Mormon universes, Latter-day Saint universes, the one out in Missouri, which says that it's a spurious document and it was concocted by Joseph Smith, and then the Utah Latter-day Saints, who are just the opposite. I don't know if that answers your question.
To do that, you would have to tell people that my first wife that died, you can't have her, or I can't have my second wife. I understand the problem with women who have to choose which husband, but I think there's many men who are prominent in the church today who expect in the hereafter to have the wives that have lived with here on the earth. And especially in the 19th century, women died readily, and so our ancestors, our male ancestors, often had several wives. I don't know how you could say to them they can only have one.
Well, let me just add one other thing. Kind of I'm sure you're well aware that some of the general authorities, I think elders Dallin Oaks and Russell Nielsen, they have taken second wives, and those second wives have been sealed to them in the temple. So theoretically, you know, they're practicing polygamy. It's not, you know, it's not concurrent polygamy, but it's sequential polygamy, and both of their wives will be with them in the hereafter. So in a sense, polygamy is still being practiced, you know, to underscore, you know, what the veracity of 132.
I wonder if you tell potential converts a big story about this.
Samuel Eastman in his teaching that excommunication doesn't revoke priesthood. That's interesting because I've heard that idea passed around word to mouth, by word of mouth, but I have never been able to find any references to it. Did Eastman originate this teaching, or did he get it from some source before him?
So if you go to Truth Magazine series, that'll come out in the 1930s, there'll be full-fledged articles on it. But usually the quote fundamentalists will use is one from Heber C. Kimball from the 1850s, in which he says, people have asked me, do I believe that there are still men with the Holy Ghost who have been excommunicated? And he says, of course I do. If an excommunication is not done for the right reasons, then it wouldn't be valid in the eyes of God. And so fundamentalists have captured that idea and said, well, you can't be excommunicated for righteousness, and we're keeping the laws God's given.
And where can I find that?
I would suggest you go on mormonfundamentalist.org.
Okay.
And Nathan Taylor runs that site, and he could hook you up with that reference right away. It'll be on one of the pages there. But usually it's the Heber C. Kimball quote used. Truth volumes are kind of hard to find, but if you're around a university library, you could just pick them up, and there'll be several articles on it. About troublemakers.
This is also an Eastman question. You talked about how there's the concept that they would overthrow the leadership of the church. Did I hear that correctly or incorrectly?
Replace the leadership of the church.
Okay, so there was a violent revolution wasn't on tap.
No, some heterodox fundamentalists, not from the ruling vein, have suggested there'll be violence. But now that I go back to that, many would believe in Section 85 and interpret that this one mighty and strong will come to replace a church leader who will be struck down in the same way as studying the ark is the reference. So in the same way when the man tries to study the ark in the Old Testament and he's struck down, that this thing will happen usually in the idea to a church leader. who will be replaced by this one man in strong.
And then one question for Newell. Guy Bishop has an article coming out of one of your books. Do you know more beyond just that it's going to be about Sidney Rigdon and the children of Zion? Can you give more information about what he's going to cover?
Well, he's basically going to focus on the opposition to polygamy, that that Sidney Rigdon became a militant opponent of plural marriage. And I discussed this briefly. I discussed the whole issue of Sidney Rigdon and then Stephen Post, who was one of his disciples. I do a little bit of that in an article that I that was published in the John Whitmer Historical Journal in 2000. Let's see, it was 2007. Was my presidential address, and I talk a little bit about that. But it's an interesting story because it shows the analog. It shows that there were kind of anticipating what happened with the RLDS Church. Only in the case of Sidney Rigdon, it was not tied to being the son of Joseph Smith or whatever. It wasn't tied to progeny and trying to legitimize it that way. It was simply Rigdon opposed it on principle. Although there's interesting, the thing I point out in my article is it appeared that maybe early on Sidney Rigdon maybe toyed with the possibility of polygamy, and I'm hoping that Guy Bishop will bring that out in his article as well, and that he's done an additional amount of research on that. I think it's a significant part of the story. He's in not the best of health right now, and I know it's been very difficult. It's been a real struggle for him to write this article, but I think it's an important story that really needs to be told because it shows after the death of Joseph Smith. So many people say, they forget what happened in these other schismatic movements, that when Mormonism splintered, they overlook Strang. They overlook what happened with Cutler, with Lyman White. Both Cutler and White practiced polygamy, and Chris is going to have an essay dealing with that in the second volume. That's going to talk about Lyman White and polygamy and Cutler and compare them, because when you think of polygamy, you just think of Brigham Young and the Utah Mormons, but there were these other Mormon groups as well, and the differing attitudes to polygamy show how Mormonism was splintered and how Joseph Smith's legacy was ambiguous, was very ambiguous, and partly tied into the secrecy that the Revelation 132 wasn't even made public until 1852.
Okay. Jay, did you say there's no substantial evidence for that?
It's circumstantial.
Okay. Jay's working on Stephen Post right now. He's going to do some good stuff.
My question is about that book that came out, The 27th Wife. What was her name? She divorced.
Annalisa Webb.
Annalisa Webb.
So, is she just a real anomaly from the other wives of Brigham Young? Did he kind of go a bit bonkers in his old age and grab this young actress or whatever she was? Through Utah.
Actually, she was like very many of these other wives. She comes from a very important Mormon family, the Webb family. She had been married before and had two children when she married Brigham. There was always a question about who did the courting. I think that Annalisa Webb used things to make it look like she was a victim. It helped her in her her speaking and her book being published. But I think she certainly, there's not any evidence that she was much of a victim, except she just didn't enjoy being with the family. She wanted fancy things. She talks about in her book that the furniture she got her own home, which was unusual for Brigham's wives, but the furniture wasn't nice enough for her. So I think she expected more than she got, and also she had a lot of support from the Protestant anti-polygamists here, and who encouraged her to tell her story. So I think that was an important part of it. It's interesting, I've been reading, or just recently read some letters of her mother, who became very bitter towards the church and towards Brigham and towards polygamy. But I think that's all after all this happened. Did I answer your question?
Yep. Yeah, just a general question on books on polygamy. Carmen Hardy's book is still relatively new, and George's book, and then Newell, your three books, and Brian's got two books coming out. How much of this do you think is actually new material, or is there much overlap? Do you see any ends of books on polygamy?
Well, the essays in our volume, I deliberately went after people and topics that I felt hadn't, you know, one of the things I mentioned that hadn't been dealt with, like 132, I mean, is such a cornerstone of Mormon, when you talk about Mormon polygamy, and there's really no scholarly, real scholarly articles done on 132, and I guess we overcompensated by ending up with three of them in volume one. That's one new topic, and then we deliberately went out, Craig and I went out and deliberately recruited, you know, new fresh essays that were dealing with topics that hadn't been dealt with or that hadn't adequately been dealt with, and we really feel that it's not going to tell the same story over again, but it's going to give differing perspectives, you know, a different perspective, maybe the stories have been, and maybe clarify mistaken perceptions of how things happened as well.
Do you know what Wilford Woodruff did after the manifesto? It pertained only to the United States because it said the laws of the United States, but they considered it all right for poor marriages to be in Mexico, to be in Canada, to be on the sea. In fact, Wilford Woodruff took a wife in 1896 on a ship out of San Francisco.
You know, I don't believe that.
I've got one more question.
Madam Mumford, I don't believe that they were married, and I think Tom Alexander's proven that that's not correct.
One of my ancestors, or one of my relatives, Anthony Woodward Ivins, my name's Woodward, he was sent to Mexico to perform plural marriages after the manifesto. And up in Canada, there was a man named Card that was sent up there to live plural marriage after the manifesto, and they named the city after him, Cardston, Canada. And what do you know about the deputies that were going out arresting men in the 1980s who were living polygamy and putting them in jail? There were a bunch of pioneers that left the United States and went to Mexico. Big colony established 12 cities. What's remaining of those things is Colonial Juarez and Colonial Dublon, where they're now a temple. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've run out of time. It's exactly, and I appreciate all of your questions and your contributions, and I think it's been a good session. Thank you for attending.